Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We're presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, we've got a good friend of the program and a special guest. It's Drake Uyu. He is a former scout executive. Kind of did a lot of different things with the Sacramento Kings and the Stockton Kings over the course of, what, 5 years, Drake? Something like that?
Yeah, 5.5 years, yep.
Yeah, so Drake is here. We're going to talk NBA playoffs. We're going to talk a little bit of everything that's happening across the league. But first, Drake, how you doing, man?
I'm great, man. I'm excited to catch up. We have a lot of these conversations. We've had a lot of these conversations over the years, and so it's cool to hit record and catch up and do a podcast. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course, man. So for people who don't know kind of who you are and like how you ended up with the Sacramento Kings and everything, just give like kind of a quick overview for the people on like kind of where you come from, how you're kind of Sacramento born and bred, and then you end up working for the hometown team for a while after kind of a storied professional career as an NBL champion.
Well, thank you for making me sound a lot cooler than I actually am, but yeah, I'm born and raised in Sacramento. Grew up a huge Kings fan in the heydays with Peja, Vladi, Chris Webber, Mike Bibby.
Well, it's great because you got to work with those guys for a while too.
Totally. That interview experience was surreal in itself. I was like freaking out. Couple childhood celebrities in my mind. so it was pretty wild. But yeah, grew up in Sacramento. Huge Kings fan. Those teams were, from 2000 to 2005 were like I feel like they're what really shaped my love for the game. But yeah, I ended up playing in high school, played in college. I ended up graduating from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. And then from there, I wanted to keep playing and, landed in Perth, Australia. So, pretty cool experience, pretty cool. I'm understating it. Australia was amazing. living in the beach, English-speaking country. It's summertime during the basketball season there. The Perth Wildcats organization is first class, and ironically ended up playing on the same team as a guy that I played against in college in James Ennis my rookie year. Won a championship. And so, yeah, it was a total blessing from start to finish. And from there, I actually had I had originally signed a 3-year deal with Perth. I opted out with a player option because I was hoping to get some more opportunity with a different NBL club. And so, like, the whole way that the Kings door opened was completely out of the blue. Got a call from a mutual friend with Vladi, who had just taken the job at the time, asking if I could come in an interview with Vladi tomorrow. I thought this was a joke. So I said, of course, dropped everything I was doing. This was August, so I was literally getting ready to head back to Australia in like a couple weeks. And interviewed with Vladi and Peja, who both came in, were super down to earth. The conversation went really well. And they told me eventually, they're like, well, we'll get back to you in a couple weeks. And so I messaged my buddy and I'm like, hey, I kind of need to make a decision whether I'm going to go back to Australia or I kind of like to see this through before, making this call. And Vladdy called me that night and offer letter was there. And I just quickly decided to pivot and hang up my basketball shoes and kind of dive into a role in the front office. And so spent 5.5 years with the Kings. Incredible experience. Wouldn't take anything back. It was a dream job for me working, growing up, like I said, as a Kings fan, and then being able to work with, guys like Vladdy and Peja, who are amazing humans, and grew up a huge fan, obviously. So I was fanboying for the last 5.5 years, essentially. And here we are.
It's amazing, though. It's like just an unreal story. And then, unfortunately, obviously you got let go in the changeover, which happens to front office people all the time. And you've been just doing a little bit of scouting on the side and kind of hanging out and doing your thing in Sacramento. So I'm glad that the Kings' loss is the Game Theory Podcast's gain.
One man's trash is another man's treasure. That's right, Tim. Thank you.
So let's jump in and talk about the NBA and talk a little bit about this Clippers-Mavs game that happened earlier today. So the Clippers end up knocking out the Mavs after being down 2-0, being down 3-2 in this series. And I don't think I'm surprised, because this Mavericks team, just looking at how that roster has been built, I'm not really a fan of it, right? Tim Hardaway Jr. was their second best player this year. Kristaps Porzingis just does not look to be back from the litany of injuries that he's unfortunately had to deal with over the course of his career. And like Dorian Finney-Smith was arguably more valuable than Kristaps was this year, despite the fact that Kristaps averaged like 20-8. So I'm not surprised that the Mavs couldn't keep it together for a game 7, but man, it was a fun ride in this entire series. And man, it was a fun ride in game 7, because that was a roller coaster watching Luka kind of go off through the first quarter and first half.
Unreal. I mean, but did he finish with 29 at half? I think he was virtually unguardable this entire series. And it's crazy to see him take another step. Last year we saw in the playoffs too at the bubble. I feel like when the lights are on, and he just takes his game to another level, which is pretty cool to see.
Yeah, he's kind of always been like that too. The number that I've been kind of showing on Twitter, I guess, or tweeting out is that, he has 5 games out of 13 playoff games now where he has 40 points and 9 assists, including today. He did it again. I think he had like 42 and 13 or 14 or something, which are just like literal video game numbers. He's one of now 3 players in NBA history to do that. Like LeBron, I think, has done it 9 times in like 180 NBA playoff games or whatever.
Wow.
It's what Luka is doing is not normal. Like Dallas has the hard part done. Finding that guy is the hard part. I mean, you guys spent 5.5 years in Sacramento trying to find that guy and you didn't. And now this guy is here and Dallas has the tough part done. It's building around that guy that's going to be the hard part, and we'll see where it goes, right?
100%, yeah. I feel like, trust me, I hear a lot about Luka from enough of my friends over the years.
I didn't want to say it. You know what I mean? I was gonna let you bring it up if you wanted to.
I would love to. Building in a draft is incredibly hard, and we were clearly wrong, but. Luka is a special generational talent. It's just I'm trying to figure out what their next step is. I mean, Porzingis is clearly supposed to be the number 2 guy. I feel like you kind of need to – is it shooting? You just need to surround him with knockdown guys and maybe another playmaker?
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that they need. They need a second guy who can be – just instant offense, right? Because Kristaps can't really create his own shot. He's never been a post creator. He's never been, he's been like kind of a mid post guy you could throw the ball to, and maybe he can hit a fadeaway or just like, honestly, that shot where he has the high release point and just ends up shooting over the top of a guy that's like 6'10" or shorter. But I'm of the mind that the first thing they need to go out and find is a secondary playmaker. Or even a primary guy that can take some of the burden off of Luka. Like, I've seen a couple people bring up the Kemba Walker for Kristaps Porzingis potential move. Mm-hmm. If I was Boston, I would never do that. I just want to make that abundantly clear. I would rather have Kemba for 2 years than Porzingis for three. I understand why people would bring that up, because Boston has a theoretical need at center. But I think they're probably just going to ride with Robert Williams and see where that goes, or maybe take a guy at 16 as opposed to that. I mean, they could look to get rid of Kemba, but the whole point of getting rid of Kemba would be to like kind of be able to reset with a different cap situation in a year, I think, as opposed to replacing him with another highly paid underperforming star, right?
Right, right, totally.
So if you're Dallas, I think primary playmaker first and foremost, and then I liked the Josh Richardson move in a vacuum because it was like kind of shooting and defense, but it was just terrible. It didn't work. I mean, I don't know. Like, what do you think? Like, I would, my initial thing is playmaking and shooting defense, like two-way players, kind of like in the Dorian Finney-Smith role, but they tried that last year and it failed. Like, what are we thinking for Dallas?
I think you're 100% right. Like, the secondary ball handler playmaker has to, I don't know where they find that necessarily, but taking some pressure off of Luka. And then, yeah, surrounding him, I guess, like, some combination of shooters and dogs. And that's kind of what you kind of have in Finney-Smith. I'm a Jalen Brunson fan. He's been pretty solid for them, I think, the last couple of years. And, he brings some toughness, but I think you need someone that can, like, really take the pressure off of Luka from a playmaking standpoint. So I'm super curious. I mean, Porzingis is making, what, 31 next year, 33 the year after that, and he has a $36 million in 23-24. That's a lot of money.
It's a wild amount of money, I feel like, for him, unfortunately. But they have some real cap space this summer, too. That cap space does drop if they decide to try and hold on to Tim Hardaway Jr. and his $28 million cap hold, right? I don't know this. I'm assuming Josh Richardson probably opts out of that $11 million. He could at least, I would think, get at least like 8 or 9 on the open market. Like maybe he doesn't get the full 11, but he can get 8 or 9 on a longer term deal.
Yep.
Or like, would he rather just take that one and then try to run it back and see how next year goes to re-enter the market? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he played 6 minutes today, took one shot. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's if he's not feeling the fit or if they don't really necessarily see him. I don't know. You're right. Maybe he opts out and tries to get in a better situation for himself. But interesting.
Yeah, and so they're, let's say they even have to do that $28 million cap hold on Tim Hardaway. So that takes them up to like 101 guaranteed. Josh Richardson gets them up past like the salary cap, which is projected at 112 next year. So this is a team that, depending on what Josh Richardson does, and then depending on what they decide to do with Tim Hardaway Jr., they're going to be keeping their options open, I think, first and foremost. And then kind of secondly, I think that they need to just look on the market and see if they can, could you potentially go out and try and get like a Lonzo Ball? Like, do we think Lonzo's a good enough secondary creator next to Luka, or is he just going to cause more of the same issues for them in the half court? Cause he's not a great half court creator, I feel like.
Right. It's an interesting, I don't know. I feel like, Lonzo has improved as a shooter. That's actually not bad. I mean, and I wouldn't necessarily, is Lonzo like a great half court creator? Like you said, like he's more of a kick ahead transit, great in transition. It's an interesting name for sure.
The other name I've seen is DeMar DeRozan, but he isn't the shooter spacer. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, and he's kind of like, the ball kind of sticks with him at times. I don't know if he's that.
I don't think you'd want Luka next to a guy where the ball gets sticky in their hands, like with DeMar.
Yeah, I've always thought that, this is super random. Obviously, I'm Shaq biased, but maybe someone like Buddy, kind of in alongside Tim Hardaway. I mean, I don't know how the money works with that, obviously, but I do think that the shooting, to me, because the ball is in his hand so much, he's trying to get downhill, and once he's making plays, he can obviously pick defenses apart and just kind of putting more shooting around him, I think, would help. It's tricky. I don't know what Dallas does. Clearly, it sounds like they're not making a coaching change. So, yeah.
I think that the other one that I like that I haven't seen mentioned yet is Spencer Dinwiddie. Spencer, again, the ball does get a bit sticky with him. And he's not an elite shooter, but he's a good enough shooter to where I think that I don't think the price is going to be wild. Like, I think you're talking $15 million or so, maybe something like that. And that's more the guy that I think makes sense for them. Something in like in the Dinwiddie mold who can shoot, who I think would probably take a number two option as opposed DeMar took a number two option. I don't want to like, you know, say that DeMar didn't necessarily like he'd be comfortable with that. But I think that Dinwiddie from a price perspective probably fits a little bit more and fills a few more holes for them. Maybe.
I like that a lot actually. And Dinwiddie can play with the ball in his hands too. And so you kind of, I guess now I'm thinking about it. Tim Hardaway is solid off the dribble. I feel like he can create his own shot, but I think maybe that's a little more that Dinwiddie that Dinwiddie name is actually an interesting one for sure.
So where do we think the Clippers succeeded here? Kind of watching this game, like what was impressive about the Clippers' performance for you today?
Kawhi to me is the one who kind of elevated his game, took it upon himself to try and not switch as much on Luka. He was just he was a beast today. I feel like I'd kind of been waiting to see this. And after they went down 0-2, I feel like we started to kind of – I mean, look, he was 10 for 15 today, got to the line, almost had a triple-double, zero turnovers. I feel like, talk about a two-way player. I feel like his performance today was super impressive to me. And it's – yeah, I mean, and then on top of that, like, the role players late and Reggie Jackson and Marcus Morris just went nuts. And I feel like that, to me, was the difference maker tonight, was kind of those third, fourth, fifth guys kind of stepping up. Trey Mann. I'm getting confused now with draft guys. But, Trey Mann, I thought, had great minutes. Oh, and Luke Kennard even came in and played a major role late. And so I feel like a lot of those role players today stepped up when they needed to, and they, at the end of it, got it done.
Yeah, how good is Terrence Mann? Trey Mann is the draft prospect, unfortunately. It always happens. Those stupid brain fades always happen. Terrence Mann, like, becoming a real NBA player is, like, one of my favorite things, because if you've ever talked to Terrence Mann, did you guys have him pre-draft last year?
You know what? We had him pre-draft, and we also went to Portsmouth and interviewed him, and, yeah, awesome kid.
Just, like, elite of the elite in terms of, like, character, like, good person, all about the team. Like, did that kind of stuff stand out to you guys?
100%. All the intangibles that you want in a – especially, I mean, you could see the maturity in the way that he kind of approached the workout, how he approached an interview. I'm actually a huge Terrence Mann fan. I mean, his role has obviously increased this year. He's taken advantage of his opportunity, and he's become like a great utility role player for LA. And I think you couldn't be happier for kids like that. You really love seeing them succeed.
Yeah. And with him, it's like that ability to process the game. Like, the big thing that I always talk about, like, on this podcast, is I want guys that are quick at processing basketball and can make quick decisions. And I think that with particularly Terrence Mann and Nick Batum, they have found guys that are really good at that and then are also versatile and smart defenders. I would imagine that they end up playing a little bit bigger against the Jazz, because I think it's just really hard to play without any size against Gobert because of how strong he is. But with that, with what they did against Luka and against Dallas, essentially guarding Porzingis with a small, and then guarding Boban with a small at times as well. Boban had 14 and 10, but if Boban is beating you, I feel like that's a win for the Clippers, totally, as opposed to Luka or Tim Hardaway Jr. canning threes, or Luka spraying the ball out for wide open threes. So, yeah, guys who can process the game quickly on both offense and defense, I feel like those are the two things that, or really the one thing that showcases itself on both ends that that I look for a lot in the draft process and look for in draft prospects.
Totally.
Where do you fall on this Utah Clippers series? How do we think this is going to go?
I actually think I have Utah coming out of the West.
Have you had that the whole playoffs?
I think from the start of the playoffs, I had Utah. I feel like I've just been super impressed with the maturity, the depth. I feel like they seem to really be clicking. Mike Conley is much more comfortable in his role this year. I don't know. I am excited for the series, obviously, but I think I have Utah still kind of prevailing. I feel like they have set this great balance of maturity, IQ. They have obviously a star in Donovan, and I feel like they really, chemistry-wise, they really mesh well together, and they pick defenses apart, and they have several, they hit you from a variety of different angles, and I don't know. I just don't know if the Clippers can hang. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that people have been drastically underrating how good Utah is all season.
Yeah.
I mean, they are very... Yeah, and Phoenix. And with Utah, I think that everyone just kind of waits for the shoe to drop because of the propensity to play drop coverage. And that seems to be everyone's kind of... you know, the thing that everyone hates right now. You can't play drop coverage in the playoffs. You can't make it work at the end of the day. You know what, though? The Jazz, I feel like, know that better than anyone because they absolutely annihilate drop coverage, first and foremost, offensively. So
right. It
becomes really hard to play. The reason I think Utah is so good is it's really hard to play small against them because Rudy will destroy you on the glass if you do. And because, yeah, he doesn't post necessarily, but he does like roll and seal really well so that if you play a small on him, he's going to be able to just high point the ball and score on you pretty easily. But it's really hard to play truly big against them. Like Zubats is going to have all sorts of problems in the series because if you drop against them, they have so many pull-up shooters who are great. Donovan Mitchell, Mike Conley, obviously. Joe Ingles can kind of walk behind a screen and knock it down. Jordan Clarkson's very comfortable doing it. Boyan's obviously very comfortable doing it as well. And all of those guys are also excellent catch-and-shoot guys. And Mike particularly, as well as Donovan and Boyan to an extent, and certainly Joe, all of those guys are such good passers. They spray the ball so well out to those kick-out guys. I think it's really, really hard to play big against them, but it's also hard to play small against them. It's kind of a perfect storm of offensive skills without like a superstar player. And that's why they're so good offensively and so difficult to deal with, right?
Totally. Yeah. They pick you apart. They really do. And they got great guard play. I wasn't a huge Gobert fan. I don't know. My opinion of him has changed. I think my opinion on rim protectors in general and like true bigs and size has changed dramatically. And so, Utah is a really good team. And I don't know. I mean,
well, how has your opinion of rim protectors changed? Like, what do you mean when you say that?
I think looking at the bubble and when you look at playoff teams, I guess I didn't value it as much as I do now. I think that, you know, you look at the Jokic's, the Embiid's, the having true rim protection is kind of the anchor of your defense, and especially in today's game where you know, playing on the perimeter, you can't touch a guy, and so you have having someone that can like really alter shots or you know, protect that rim, I think is like super valuable. And I kind of downplayed that, I think, at times, you know, in my time with the Kings, as far as like my personal evaluation of players. I think that it's just a much more valuable skill than I anticipated. And so,
yeah, and it's interesting too, because I kind of agreed with you. Like, I almost would have always rather had like the Bam Adebayo, for instance, exactly. Right?
Yep.
Or, yep, the switchable defensive center as opposed to like the true big that you're playing in a drop and then making it work. But even just look at that Clippers Mavs series, I felt like a big part of it was the Mavericks adjustment back after game four or game five, I can't remember, was to bring in Boban off the bench and kind of start him and play him a bunch of minutes and just play like super huge humans in the paint and basically making the Clippers play as a perimeter based team, which is something that, they're very comfortable doing, and I think that they prefer it, but I think they prefer it to their detriment at times. And where they got very dangerous in games three and four was the parade to the rim. So the way Dallas adjusted back was to go with super rim protection. I do think that it's really important to be able to protect the rim, and that kind of goes with, like, it's so intuitive to say that, but I feel like we did go away from it for a minute in the NBA.
Totally, yeah.
And like over evaluating the ability to kind of just play in a variety of different pick and roll coverages. But, and I think that it's important to still be able to show teams different looks, right? It's important to be able to show different ways of combating what the offense is going to do. You know, you should be able to play flat. You should be able to, trap and try and force a turnover, and put two on the ball, right? You should be able to, drop, and you should be able to switch, right? Like, you need to do all of those things. That's what genuine NBA champions do. But I do think more and more that the best way to build a defense is probably inside out, at least in terms of raising the floor of your defense.
Sure. Yeah. Do you feel like, because I know I'm kind of thinking in my own, but Dallas's situation with their bigs was actually super interesting. And like you said, that they obviously at the end of it decided to go with Boban. But I was always kind of curious, like, throughout the season, they were going with Willie Cauley-Stein, they were going with Dwight Powell, Finney Smith was playing some center with when Porzingis was out. Like, they kind of, and every one of those bigs has, like, obviously these different qualities and different skill sets. And so what, my question to you, I guess, is like, what is your ultimate like taste, or what would you like most out of your, so what do you look for the most out of your centers?
I think that now, I mean, this is a ridiculous thing to say, right? But I feel like there are all these different kind of molds that centers are built in now, like the Clint Capella rim protection rim runner, who is athletic and can switch a little bit, but is probably a little bit better playing either flat or playing a drop coverage in defense. There is the pure spacer, like a Porzingis, right? There is the space and rim protect, which is what Porzingis used to be, such as Miles Turner. There's the kind of ability to catch all and do everything, right? And then you have Anthony Davis, like that. I think I would want the guy who can, I think even more than shooting now, I want the guy who's comfortable with the ball in his hands and is good at rim protection, but also switchable defensively. Like the guy that stands out to me in this draft that is Evan Mobley, obviously, because he can just kind of do a lot of different things, but also like Usman Garuba can do a lot of that. He's really switchable, can go out and play in a variety of any pick and roll coverage you want to play. He's only 6'8", but he has incredible length and is really good at walling up around the basket. But even above shooting, he's really comfortable. Like, you could play him in dribble handoffs. You could play him, you know, as a release valve if the other team puts two on the ball. There's just a lot that you can do, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I feel like it's funny because I always, I mean, especially come playoff time, everything's switchable or switching. And so, like, on one hand, I'm like, well, I want a big that is mobile enough and comfortable on the perimeter. And here we are thinking about these unicorns. I want this, 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 and this. But
right.
And I love rim runners. I think that, like, I really love, like, a guy like Rashawn Holmes. I think maybe with a little more size, a little more comfort as far as, like, maybe some post game. But I've always kind of leaned more towards those rim runners, guys that move well, that are comfortable, like I said, you know, switching onto guards on the perimeter. Like, that's kind of how that's how I still kind of am. Those are kind of more of the qualities I look for from that position. But yeah, it's just an interesting conversation that I feel like come playoff time, like you said, all these different teams have, it's all about matchups. And so trying to figure out, you know, which guy, I mean, who knows, maybe we'll see DeMarcus Cousins next round after not playing. I mean, it's all about matchups in the playoffs and fun stuff to think about.
Yeah, I think that More. I think that like it, defensively, I want someone who can protect the rim and space a little bit at least, guard away from the basket a little bit. Like I do want someone with at least like Clint Capella level of ability to switch. Like you don't feel great when Clint Capella's out on an island against a guard, but like he can handle the job a little bit, right?
Totally. Yeah.
I at least want that. And then even more than shooting, I want guys who are dexterous with the ball and can kind of do a lot of different things. I think that that's kind of, if I'm building a team, those are the skills that I'm placing at the highest priority. Now, that's not to say that, like, if Miles Turner was to come available on the trade market, which, like, who knows, right? Given the fact that they have both Sabonis and Turner, that I wouldn't take Miles Turner over a lesser center. Right? I would, because Miles Turner is great and you can make it work with Miles Turner because he's such a good defender and can shoot. But I think that in a vacuum, those are kind of the skills that I prioritize from the center position now.
Yep. Nice.
All right, Drake, let's take a quick commercial break and then we will be back with a little bit more on these final three playoff series. Okay, and we're back here at the Game Theory Podcast with Drake Yuyu. What series do you want to go to next? Do you want to do Hawks Sixers because they played today? Do you want to do Denver Suns? Do you want to do Bucks Nets because they played yesterday? What are you thinking?
Let's talk Philly Atlanta.
Okay.
I kind of like this series.
So I was talking
Atlanta winning.
I was talking to you on the phone. That was probably a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago. And yeah, I said to you, I think that Atlanta poses a lot of problems for Philadelphia. And this was before Joel Embiid got hurt.
Right.
The reason is mostly because, you know, we just spent a while talking about like rim protection and about, playing drop coverage and everything and how you can do it. But the problem is that Philly doesn't really do anything else because you can't really do anything else with Joel out on the floor. And then on top of that, I kind of thought that Trae Young was just going to eat in this series. And in the first game, he had 35 and 10, and he just basically ate whenever he wanted to eat.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you think watching that game?
You know, to me, I've been really impressed. I think since the switch in coaches, Nate McMillan has like transformed Trae's game completely. I think that's kind of my biggest takeaway from the year. And what I mean by that is obviously Trae's putting up big numbers. He's had an all-star year already. But to me, it's the decision-making, the shot selection. And his game seems to have matured significantly. And teammates seem to like really enjoy playing with him. And he's making the game easy for guys. And so I think that like Nate has like instilled a defensive minded philosophy. He's I think he's got great depth on this team. I'm a huge fan of a lot of their young wings, and then the addition of Bogey I think has obviously been a huge plus for them. But I think that they actually match up really well with Philly. And yeah, I don't know if they really have an answer for Trae, and they didn't today, and I don't know if they will. I think that maybe they switch Ben onto him full time but Atlanta is so deep to me, and they have a good balance similar to Utah, and they seem to be kind of clicking. And this second half of the season they've definitely clicked as a unit. I really like Atlanta's chances. I think that they did a good job neutralizing Embiid today, and yeah, I wasn't surprised at all that they won. And the one thing that was crazy, that I don't know if you caught the game, but the very end, I'm like, you take your eyes off the game for a couple minutes, and all of a sudden this 20-point lead dwindles all the way down, and suddenly all these possessions came down to a free-throw game at the very end. But they were able to hold on. But, I'd like this Atlanta team a lot.
Yeah, I had to catch this as a rewatch, because this game happened at 3 a.m. in the morning here in Australia. I'm getting used to having to just rewatch games. I'm typically someone who mostly time shifts games and like watches them later so that I can watch them in 50 minutes as opposed to like 2.5 hours. But during the playoffs, I watch a lot more live and have gotten used to watching a lot more live. So that was a tough one to miss. I mean, with Atlanta, they kind of just have a lot of the things that you look for in a good playoff roster. They have an elite creator in Trae Young who processes the game exceptionally quickly. He is a three-level scorer who is an unbelievable passer. You have a legit defensive center in Clint Capella, who is great. You have another young, burgeoning star in John Collins. You have a motherfucker of a shot maker in Bogey. Like, there's no circumstance he's on the Atlanta Hawks, I would imagine, if you guys were still working in Sacramento, right?
I think that, Bogey would be a king for life if we're still there. But yeah, pretty amazing. I'm super happy for Bogey to at least have the opportunity to play in the playoffs. Everybody's now he's playing on a national stage, and he's like, again, like we talked about with Terrence Mann, he's just like such an amazing human, and plays best when the lights are on and on the biggest stage. And so, but yeah, I'm with you.
In the case of Bogey too, like it's funny, like I mean, this is another thing that I tweeted like right when the playoffs started, but like, I think people don't recognize Bogdan Bogdanovic's like history of big moment exploits, right? He is not a guy to like mess around with in the playoffs. He will absolutely destroy you if you give him any sort of space, and he's a legit creator in the playoffs too. He can handle the ball, he can run pick and roll. This is a guy who was the top scorer at the FIBA World Cup in 2019. He was a EuroLeague All-Decade Team member, and that is legit. Just like, it's a season, but then you have playoffs, and he was absolutely exceptional in the playoffs. He was the EuroLeague Finals top scorer in 2017. He was a Turkish League Finals MVP in 2017. He was the Serbian League Playoffs MVP in 2014 when he was 22 years old. Like, this dude just, there's never going to be a moment that's too big for him, I feel like.
Totally.
Such a good player. And then on top of it, I think it's worth noting too that Atlanta shot well today, right? They got 3-for-4 from three from John Collins. They got 3-for-6 from Herter. They got 2-for-4 from Lou Will. Bogey made 5. You know, Solomon Hill's really the only guy that didn't shoot well today. They're probably not going to shoot 20 of 47 from three every night. You're probably not going to make 43% every single night. And then on the other side, Philadelphia goes 10 of 29 from three. They shoot 35. So like, they weren't like wildly off of like a yearly percentage. But when you're talking a 4-point game, and look, I know Atlanta led by a lot for a majority of this game. Like, you're up 20 points at halftime and you're up 15 going into the fourth quarter. Like, look, it's Philly had to like scratch and claw late in this game to make it a 4-point game. But it does feel like Atlanta's probably due for some shooting regression. It feels like Philadelphia will have better shooting nights. I'm just not sure like what to make of Philadelphia's like perimeter rotation. Like, Shake Milton played 1 minute today. Maxi played more minutes than like George Hill and Furkan Korkmaz, which I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. I just kind of wonder if they're in a similar circumstance with the Clippers were early in the Dallas series, where in a hyper-competitive situation, because that first series they played was just not hyper-competitive, let's call it what it is, right? Yep, yep. In a hyper-competitive situation, I'm not sure they know who they're going to be able to rely on for those like 25 minutes off the bench that they need from their backcourt on a night-to-night basis.
Yeah, I agree. And when we start talking about the depth of Atlanta and I look at their wings and their guard play, compared to Philly's, I just don't know if Philly has the firepower, the shot making ability that Atlanta does. I mean, Thibault actually shot the ball well today, and on the flip side, I wouldn't actually I mean, that's kind of uncharacteristic of him. You're looking at him more on the defensive end, but I just, the lack of shooting and I guess depth from Philly, I think kind of worries me in this series. So I do want to ask you though, I'm kind of curious, where are you at with John Collins?
I'm a big John Collins guy. I've always been a pretty big fan. The reason is that he gets better at something every year. Like, entering the league, he was like energy, motor, rebounding guy.
Yeah.
Wake used him a lot in pick and roll, but he wasn't like versatile pick and roll threat that he is now. You know, third year he goes, gets the jump shot, and becomes like an actual versatile pick and roll threat where you can pick and pop him. You can pick and pop to where he can attack a closeout and finish. You can just roll him all the way to the basket and finish. And that combination of skills now to where he can catch and shoot and knock down shots from three allows him to play on the court with Clint Capella, which is huge for them because it gives them that little bit of added ability on defense and added size on defense. And then on top of it, he got a lot better on defense over the course of the last year and a half. Like, John Collins, I'm not sitting here saying he's like an all NBA defender. He's not even close to that level, but he's not a liability anymore. Like, when he entered the league and even in his second season, he was a genuine defensive liability. He is an average defender in the NBA now, and just getting to average, I think, is such an enormous thing for him because it allows him to stay on the floor in multiple different situations while maintaining and getting the value out of his offensive ability.
Totally. Yeah, I'm a huge John Collins fan. I'm curious to see, I would imagine, Atlanta matches anything that another team would throw at him, but I feel like, yeah, he kind of came in the league as this like super athletic, kind of rim running, lob threat big. And like you said, he just worked his butt off on both ends, but the skill set has just like really evolved nicely for him. And all of that. And then he also plays with like this great toughness and like nastiness that I think kind of, you know, between him and Trey, and they got like some young swagger on the team. And And then some of these vicious dunks that he had, like especially the one he had late, the lob, I'm like, my goodness, like he's really starting to put his game together nicely. And yeah, I think he's quietly had like a most improved player type of year on the low. So
no one will give him that award because of, like, I think honestly his numbers probably dropped a little bit this year from what they were last year, but he's a much better player now than he was last year. And it's huge for them. Like, I'm glad you brought up that toughness aspect with Atlanta. They really do have that. They're a young team. They're inexperienced. This is their first playoff run. But like, Trae Young is not going to be afraid of any moment whatsoever. John Collins, that dude is tough. He's physical. I don't think he's afraid of the moment. We know Bogey's not afraid of the moment. Herter, I think, has been unbelievable in the playoffs. Like, he was unbelievable again today. He went 6 of 9 from the field, made 3 threes, had 4 assists. Like, he's actually also been really good defensively. Did you kind of see him as being useful defensively when he entered the league? Because I certainly did not.
You know, I did, because he has, A, he has positional size, and B, he's got this, like, he's a sneaky athlete. And so for him to, I really wasn't too concerned. He moved well laterally, I thought. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, white guys are going to get targeted in the league. But I wasn't too concerned because, I mean, he'll also catch you sleeping at the rim and, you know, finish a nasty dunk over you in the lane, like, kind of out of nowhere. And so I wasn't too worried about, like, the defensive liability. I was a huge fan of his coming out of the draft. It's funny because that year in the draft room, I was so high on Trey. I was like obsessed with him. And then every year in the drafts, I get obsessed with random players. But Trey was one where I'm like, my goodness. And I was like the polarizing one in the room because we had a lot of people that were anti-Trey, like super pro Colin Sexton at the time. And those were some of the conversations we would have in that lottery. Both great young players, but it's just kind of like, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But on the draft night, everybody's like, Drake's making the calls in Atlanta. Like, oh my gosh, because some people thought that Kevin Herter should have gone back to school.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, this kid is a lottery guy. And sure enough, he shoots the crap out of it at the combine, and his stock kind of slowly starts rising. And I just loved his – he kind of has that, like, secondary third ball like playmaker ability, but also is like a knockdown shooter and can play off the ball. He's got great feel. I'm a again, I'm a big fan of this young Atlanta team. Like, they kind of have that swagger that we had briefly in that 2018 year, maybe it was, with when we won 39 games and we were playing with Shump, and you had this like young core that was kind of exciting and kind of had their own swagger to them. And I see that with this Atlanta team, and but they also have a balance of like veteran leadership and toughness, and you know, some of those role players like Solomon Hill and Tony Snell and even Gallo. I mean, guys that have been there before, and obviously Bogey. Yeah. And so it's like this unique balance, which I think is cool. They're a fun team to watch. I've liked watching them all year.
Yeah, I think Schlenk's done a really good job of building this team. He's done a really just phenomenal job of rounding out what they needed in terms of talent, in terms of just in terms of like comfort. Like even like going to get Lou Williams. Like Lou Williams has not been awesome for Atlanta, but they made the right move getting him for Rondo. I think just like kind of getting Rondo off the team a little. Like I'm not saying like Rondo was terrible. Like Rondo was terrible for them this year, but like it's not like he was like a culture, you know, asshole problem. It was just it wasn't working, and they decided to do something different. And Lou Williams is like renowned as one of the great guys like around the league. So it's just like this really nice mix of they like to be around each other. It seems like they have a really good skill mix on the floor, and then they have Trae Young and John Collins and all these guys that aren't going to be afraid of the moment. And they're talented. Like, it's just a really fun group. I really enjoy the Atlanta Hawks a lot. I don't think we're writing off Philadelphia here, right, though? Like, Joel Embiid obviously is hurt, but, I mean, they still have Ben Simmons, who, I mean, frankly, Atlanta's only way of stopping him today was to send him to the foul line. And then Joel probably will continue to dominate inside, I would think. Like, he was ridiculous today. Like, they had no answer for him. You know, they fouled him a ton, and you know, he had no problem scoring at the basket. Tobias Harris and Danny Green maybe will shoot better at some point. Like, I still think this is a 7-game series. Like, I don't think this is not going to be a walkover either way.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I am very curious to see yeah, because Atlanta, I mean, it's almost as if Philly just ran out of time, because you could sense the momentum shifting late, and you know, fortunately they were able to close it out. But you know, I'm curious to see what adjustments Doc makes, and how they plan on attacking this next game.
I think that your idea earlier of playing Ben almost full time on Trey is the right call. I don't think you can play Thibel on him, because Thibel will just like get in foul trouble like immediately. Yeah. On Trey, I think, because Trey is so good at Thibel is very over aggressive, and Trey is so good at like feeding off of that over aggressiveness. And I don't think Danny Green is quite quick enough anymore to deal with them. Like, you obviously show Trey different looks, and defense isn't like a one man game, but I think you go Ben on him, don't you?
Yeah, 100%. I think that you try and throw some size at him, and Trey's going to get to his spots. He's going to pull from wherever, and he's a nightmare to guard, because he literally he has that Steph Curry, Dame Lillard range where you have to honor him as soon as he passes half court, and then once he gets downhill or in a pick and roll, he's smart enough and has good enough feel to kind of locate or break you guys or break the defense down. So I think that maybe putting some size on him and some length and kind of muscling him up a little bit and try and get physical with him might be the move for Philly moving forward.
Yeah. I'm excited to see the rest of that series. Let's go to the Bucks and Nets, because they've actually played already. Did it surprise you that the Bucks couldn't get it done in game one when Brooklyn lost James Harden within the first minute?
It didn't surprise me. It's funny, because my boy was joking with me. He's like, "Dude, did you hear James Harden went out? What are they going to do?" I'm like, "Oh my gosh, who are they call on next? They have nobody." It's like, well, I don't know. Maybe KD steps up, or maybe Kyrie just takes more shots. It's like they're so stacked, and they have like pretty solid role players and great depth. It's like, I mean, and to be honest, they played not those three together did not play a ton this year, and so I feel like they're kind of not used to it, but I mean, this isn't anything new for them, and so I feel like I wasn't too surprised. I think that like my problem with the Bucks, and this is where a guy like Bogey would really help them, I think, is just the lack of shooting. And they didn't shoot the ball well on Saturday, and I feel like it just puts so much more pressure on a Giannis and a Drew to like try and make something happen when your role players aren't able to make shots. And especially with I feel like the Bucks to me have to play like a perfect series to beat Brooklyn. Are you as high on Brooklyn? I feel like I have Brooklyn coming out of the East personally, but I mean, what are your thoughts?
I mean, look, I have a title future on Milwaukee at 9-1, but I think I did say on the podcast before the playoffs that I forget who I recorded with to preview the playoffs, but I said I thought Brooklyn and the Clippers, if I remember correctly, were my two picks. And the Clippers almost like catastrophically made me look exceptionally dumb. We're still in it though. Don't worry. I'm sure I will make myself look dumb at some other point, but that one still does not yet look that dumb. Yeah, I just think no one's going to beat Brooklyn. I thought that the Bucks had an exceptionally interesting matchup on them because this is the series by far I'm looking forward to most, maybe of the playoffs. Like just trying to think of like the different series is that could like come together. This one is most interesting to me, especially for Brooklyn, because they don't have anyone to deal with Giannis. Like they just have no one that is really going to be able to handle him. Even in game one, I mean, he goes for 34 in 35 minutes and has like 11 rebounds and 4 assists. And, you know, Milwaukee kept going back to the well with that Giannis, you know, almost like 4-2 pick and roll, right? That stuff, I don't think Brooklyn has an answer for that. Now, the problem is that without Dante DiVincenzo, and this is going to sound really fucking dumb, I'm aware of that, because, you know, I'm going to say for a second here that, like, with Dante, a game would be different. But I actually think that it would be because the Bucks just don't have anyone to kind of eat up minutes in the backcourt right now that isn't just like target practice for Brooklyn, one of Kevin Durant or Kyrie Irving to try and get a matchup with, right? Like every time Pat Connaughton's out there, they're trying to hunt Connaughton. Every time Bryn Forbes is out there, they're trying to hunt Bryn Forbes. And with Dante, that's not a problem. And then with like Dante, you don't want Dante on Kevin Durant, but if it's Dante on Kyrie, you're not like, oh my God, we're fucking dead in the water here. It's just a normal amount of dead in the water when Kyrie has the ball, right? It's not like Bryn Forbes is guarding Kyrie. We're about to, you know, give up 3 points here with ease. So I think that the Dante loss is actually really important in this series. And then on top of it, I mean, if Brooklyn gets the kind of play that it gets from its role that it got from its role players in game one, like if it gets 18 and 14 from Blake Griffin and gets 19 points from Joe Harris, where he goes 5 of 9 from three, and then, you know, Mike James scores 12 points and Nick Claxton plays unbelievable defensively, there is not a fucking team in the NBA beating this team. Like, it's just not going to happen.
With or without James.
Yeah. With or without James. Yeah, 100%. So I want to see more of what this series looks like when Brooklyn doesn't have all of this offensive firepower from guys that it shouldn't expect to have offensive firepower from on a regular basis, like Blake, Claxton, and Mike James.
Sure. Yeah, and to be fair, like, Chris Middleton probably doesn't go 6 for 23, and
yep.
Some of these role players, I mean, Drew didn't play great. Bryn Forbes didn't play great. You're right. And they only lost by 8. So this will still be an interesting series. I just, at times when I'm watching Brooklyn, I'm like, this is like a video game. I can't believe this roster is put together. And Blake Griffin suddenly has bounce again. And yeah, like they're getting quality minutes out of everyone. Alize Johnson has had moments during this year where I'm like, my goodness, these guys are just firing on all cylinders. But I don't know. I just, the role players for Milwaukee, I don't know if they're not playing their A game, I feel like it's going to be really difficult for them.
Well, and like, look, another part of this is, and like, I don't mean to just like make this shit on Jeff Teague hour, right? But like, I mean, Jeff Teague can't play another minute in this series. Like, I know that Mike Budenholzer, like, it's just like a habit for Mike to look down the bench from his time in Atlanta and now time in Milwaukee and just be like, oh yeah, I can go trust Jeff and he'll be fine. He can't do it. Like, unfortunately, like, you just can't play Jeff in the series because he is absolutely a target for everyone when he's out there. They're going to switch him onto whoever they can every single time. And then offensively, he's just not good enough anymore. Like, he doesn't have that same speed. He's not quite as good of a shooter as he used to be. Like, there's just not really a way to make that work, I think. So they're almost resigned to playing big a lot of the time. I thought that my ideal for them was being able to play Giannis at the five and then PJ Tucker at the four and then go like Middleton, Drew Holiday, and Dante. I mean, like, I think that, like, I'd be like trying to dust off like Elijah Bryant or something. Like, see if.
Yeah, seriously, I'm looking at this bench now. I'm like, shoot, maybe give Jordan Nwora or like somebody. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like a shot.
Yeah, I think it'd be Bryant for me because, like, you know, he's been in EuroLeague, he's experienced big moments before. Like, I think that that'd be my play, try to give him Jeff Teague's minutes. But I don't know, man. Like, I thought this was going to be, like, a hard-fought seven-game series, and I don't want to overreact to one game because that's just, like, a fucking disaster idea. Right? Like, don't overreact to one game in a seven-game series. But that Milwaukee not being able to get that game after James Harden goes out after 1 minute, like, that's tough for me because you have to imagine that, like, for Brooklyn, that was a real downer moment. And for Milwaukee to not even be able to take advantage of that at all, it's hard. It's hard for me to get past that, like, you know, that mental block in my brain.
Yeah. That's fair.
I mean, when you look at this Brooklyn team, like, what do you think the best way to, like, even try and stop them is? Like, do you switch? Do you just try and play, like, flat ball screen to try and recover? Like, I don't really know what you do against them, especially when Harden's in. But, like, even when it's just KD and Kyrie and then Joe Harris in a corner, it's hard.
Yeah, I don't know. This might not even make sense, but I feel like you just got to continue to make these guys defend. Like, I don't know if there's an answer to stop them offensively. They just have such great, talented individual guys that can go get a bucket whenever they want. But maybe on the offensive, like, they just spread them out, keep them moving, try and make them defend as much as possible. I mean, I don't know what the answer is to, I guess, is the my short answer.
I think that you're on the right track in terms of, like, making them defend. Like, maybe it's make them defend and then make shots on your end so that they can't get out in transition, right? Like, if they're out in transition and scoring, you know, a certain number of points in transition, you're probably screwed as it is. But, I mean, maybe it just has to be a track meet, right? Like, maybe Milwaukee just has to knock down threes and make it work.
This is why I personally would love to see a Brooklyn-Utah series, because Utah's, now that I'm thinking about it, they're kind of that team that can put them in enough action to, like, start thinking and, like, you know, maybe there's mishaps on defense, or they have to, like, Utah to me just kind of plays what the defense gives them. And so I feel like they might be that one unique team that is, like, deep enough, matches up decently. I don't know how Gobert fits in that series right now off the top of my head, but kind of like that style, like the Golden State, like, where just people are constantly moving, cutting, people are making the right read, smart players are kind of stretching them out. That kind of would be interesting for me to see.
Honestly, like, do we think it? I mean, Atlanta's just not talented enough, I don't think, yet. But, like, Atlanta's like mix of, like, their matchups are not disastrous. Like, against Philly, like, I feel like Philly has the best shot to defend them because Philly just has more defensive talent than anyone, like, in the league, basically, because they have all of Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, Matisse Thybulle, Danny Green, you know, down the lineup. But, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like maybe, like, the mix of offense and defense, but Atlanta's just not talented enough, probably, right?
I don't know. I actually really like Atlanta. I'm not saying that they'll – I mean, I don't even know if they'll get out of this round. I think they will. But I would love to see an Atlanta-Brooklyn series, now that you mention it. I feel like, again, they have that youth in them that might make them – it gives them that false confidence, but they, you know, they start thinking, shoot, we can beat anybody.
Right.
And they have a star in Trey, and they have again, we've talked about it, but the balance of that team, the depth of that team, the shooting that they have, that would be a really interesting matchup. I don't, obviously Brooklyn is the superior talent, but, that would be something that I, again, would like to see. And I think that they would put some – you're right. They match up really well, and they put some pressure on Brooklyn for sure.
For Milwaukee to get back into this series, I would say, like, first and foremost, it's hard because, like, I just want to say play better for a lot of this. But, like, Chris Middleton just has to play better. He has to shoot better than 6 of 23 from the field. Like, Drew Holiday has to shoot better than 7 of 19 and 2 of 7 from 3. If – Drew Holiday and Chris Middleton go 2 of 12 from 3, and Chris Middleton misses an additional 12 shots, Milwaukee just can't win these games. Like, they just can't. Yeah. So, the adjustments, I guess, are don't play Jeff Teague and play better. But, like, that just feels – it feels, like, silly – like, that's not analysis. You know what I mean?
Sure. No, I mean, yeah, make more shots. But, I mean, in reality, to me, like, the one thing about the playoffs, two things that I think are actually interesting is that we talked about, like, the switching thing. Like, everybody will just attack Jeff Teague as soon as he's on the court. Like, that seems to be the MO come playoff time. It's like, I'm going to put my best player and switch him on to your worst defender and try and create that switch and then just play. Like, my best player is going to go against yours. And, like, that seems to always be a theme the last couple of years in the playoffs, maybe the last decade. And then, to me, it's the role players. Like, I just love finding, but you start seeing, like, certain guys kind of shine in this role and, like, end up contributing to wins. And ultimately, like, those guys are the X factors that put these teams over the line. And so the Pat Connaughtons, the Bryn Forbes, and then, yeah, if it's Elijah Bryan or Jordan Nwora or PJ Tucker, like, those guys have to play better for them to have a chance, you know? And so I can go through role players on all these different rosters that I've loved watching in the playoffs because, like, to me, those are kind of the difference makers in these series.
Yeah, and, like, Nick Claxton, for instance, with Brooklyn, right? Like, his ability to play all sorts of different defensive coverages, he was all over the place and helping this game. Yep. Like, Nick Claxton was huge for Brooklyn. Like, you know, not as big as Kevin Durant and not as big as Kyrie and Blake Griffin going for 18, but, like, getting those 14 minutes from Nick Claxton, like, getting positive 14 minutes from Nick Claxton versus the dog shit 14 minutes they got from Jeff Teague, like, that's the difference, right?
Totally.
Would Mike James be the second best creator on the Dallas Mavericks?
Actually, yes. Like, I'm such a – Mike James is so nasty to me. Like, from a – his entire offensive skill set, his offensive package is crazy. Like, the finishes, the – he makes tough shots. I feel like – again, you kind of mentioned Dinwiddie, but they need someone that can kind of play on the ball and create for themselves, create for someone else outside, like, in addition to Luka. But yeah, Mike James, he's so fun to watch, like, so shifty. He'll hit you with, like, a Wilt Chamberlain hook shot from the free throw line, like, a floater from three. He'll, you know, crazy step backs. He's got the ball on a string. He's, I'm a big fan, but now you have James Harden out and insert Mike James, who's like a world-renowned scorer who can, like, you just have another stud coming off the bench and, oh, let me pick this tool now. Actually, I want this guy to come out here. take this away? Okay, I got Blake Griffin, but, like, Blake when he's 25 coming back to life now. I'm like, okay.
The problem with Mike James is Mike James thinks he's every bit as good as James Harden.
Oh yeah, and Kyrie. It's like, this is the big. I'm in the big three.
Yeah, this is now my big three. and it's good to have that confidence at times, but there will be a moment. Like, there was a point in the third quarter of that game where he, like, it was either the third or early fourth, where, like, there was a very clear reversal to Kyrie, and Kyrie would have either been able to take a three or would have been able to like attack the closeout and get to a floater or get to a shot at the rim. And he looked off Kyrie. I was like, oh my God, Mike James.
Waves him off.
I got like, this. Takes a look at him and is like, nah, I'm good. I got it. Like, guy in front of me, I'm fine.
Oh, I love it. Yep.
Let's talk about this last series. Let's talk about Denver and the Suns. I mean, I'm at the point where I just refuse to bet against Nikola Jokic, like, at any point, period. The Suns should win this series. I understand that. Just based off of talent, they are so much better across the perimeter. They can throw Mikal Bridges on Michael Porter and cause him all sorts of problems. You know, then you have the backcourt combination of Chris Paul and, you know, obviously Devin Booker, who looks unbelievable in the playoffs. Honestly, if we're being real about it, the Suns should win this series in maybe five games. But I think there is one specific problem for Phoenix, and it's that DeAndre Ayton versus Nikola Jokic is not a good matchup for Phoenix. Because Jokic is going to just attack him and try to get him directly into foul trouble every single time, I think. And if he does get DeAndre into foul trouble, they have nothing behind him. Like, they have Dario Saric playing the five. They have Frank Kaminsky. Like,
right.
You just... DeAndre Ayton is the most important player in this series, I think, in like period, point blank. If he can deal with Nikola Jokic and stay on the court for 34 minutes a night, Phoenix will win in five. But if he can't, this becomes a real series in a hurry, and it becomes like a somewhat dangerous one for Phoenix.
Yeah, I agree with you. I feel like Phoenix, I really like Phoenix. They've been fun to watch too all year. This like whole Chris Paul experiment is just my respect for Chris has just gone through the roof. I'm such a fan now, and then like to see how his leadership has clearly done wonders for this young Suns team. But I feel like they also just play well as a team. They kind of have again a great balance, good depth, good role players. But yeah, I don't know how they. I mean, I was just thinking this too. Like, yeah, if Ayton gets in foul trouble or Jokic is, it's crazy. Like I didn't watch a ton of Denver this year, and then you start watching the playoffs and you see his numbers, but it's just like, man, you forget how good and like special he really is. He's like so skilled, so it's so rare that you can, you know, obviously throw it in. Anytime you can get a guy can get a bucket at will, I feel like, especially down the stretch, like some of those, like that Portland game that went to triple overtime, like he's just so special in those moments. Like watching, I know I'm getting sidetracked, but like he's a stud. And so I'm curious, like, do you think they end up, like, if Ayton does go down, I'm assuming they're not going to call Frank the Tank off the bench. I would imagine they go, like, do you put a Jay Crowder on him? Like, that's kind of the beauty of Jay Crowder to me is, I mean, he would kind of switch from LeBron to AD. You kind of, he's like that utility, strong, physical presence. But, like, yeah, I'm curious what they do if Ayton does get in foul trouble.
I mean, they might put Jay on him because that, honestly, like, that might be their best move. Like, you might be right. Jokic will destroy him. He's just too small. Yeah. Like Jay's like 6'5" with like a 6'11" wingspan. Like Jokic is just going to shoot over the top of him. And frankly, like Jay is really strong. Jokic is stronger and will just like bury him on the block. So.
I mean, that's what he's doing to Covington. And Covington's like
6'8". Yeah.
6'9". Yeah.
Like so big guy.
Yeah. I do think that Phoenix wins. I feel like, again, to me, the depth, and then obviously a star in Book, who's playing at an incredibly high level. But to me, like, Phoenix's role players, like these young guys, like, first of all, Campaign, like those guys, him alone, who's like kind of revitalized his career and has played like a major role off the bench for them, has been pretty cool to watch.
I got nothing on that one.
Like, what do you mean?
How did that happen?
I don't know, right? I'm like, I mean, there was times where, yeah, you needed. He was like on a 10-day radar, and now he did sign a 10-day actually, right? And they signed him to the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Super cool. I love, and like he kind of plays with some swagger and some confidence, and kind of clearly has a clear understanding of who he is now as a player. And it's crazy seeing again his resurgence. But then, like, you have the young wings. I love Mikal Bridges. I love Cam Johnson. Like, two quality wing defenders and shot makers. So, yeah, I mean, I think Phoenix pulls this off. And, yeah, I could, it's five games like you. But,
yeah.
I mean.
Sorry, Sam.
All right, Drake, do you have any other strong takes on this Phoenix series? I feel like once we get to the point where Campaign is the third leading scorer on the Phoenix Suns in the playoffs, that might be all we need. I mean, I love seeing Austin Rivers blow it up a little bit for Denver. Michael Porter Jr. continues to be, you know, as awesome as what people thought he would be coming out for Denver as well, but it's just tough when you don't have the firepower in the backcourt, I feel like.
Totally agreed.
All right. Let's see here. Do you want to finish with like 5 minutes of draft stuff? I'll just ask you, who's the guy that in watching some tape this year, who's the guy that's like stood out to you as like way underneath the radar?
Way underneath the radar.
Or not even way underneath, but just like the guy that you think is way better than where people have him.
Oh, interesting. I was going to talk about Josh Giddey. And I actually have him like, as I've very quickly put together a board over the last couple weeks and just kind of been getting into this year's draft, I feel like Giddey to me is like a top, I have him like at seven, maybe six or seven in this class. I don't know where you have him actually pretty high too in your board. I just saw you have him at like
10 or 11. Yeah. Something like that. Okay. So I'm pretty high.
Yeah. I think he's a pretty special. I mean, what are your thoughts on this draft actually, like high level? Because I know we talked about this in a couple past conversations, but I feel like, you know, I've been hearing about this draft class for like the last 2 years. And I think that like the interesting part is you had a lot of kids with some like impressive high school resumes that came in and kind of underperformed at the college level. And so I'm curious, like, do you, obviously to me, the top five, you have like a couple studs that can potentially be like starter, all-star level caliber players. But I did think that like, I thought that there would be a couple more studs than that. Do you think it's a deep draft? Do you think it's a strong draft?
It's a great question. I think it's a great draft at the top. I think those top four guys are just like very real. I think it is a poor draft in that like 6 to 20 range. And then from like maybe 25 to 50, I feel like there are some flyers that I really like. Like I really am kind of interested in like Bones Highland. I'm really interested in Miles McBride. Like I think Miles McBride is like Deuce is a first round pick to me. Having really gone through his tape this weekend, particularly, I was like kind of blown away a little bit. Like I think I would take him. I think I would take him over Sharif Cooper, to be honest, because he played in that like just terrible West Virginia system for the first half of the year. And then you look in the second half of the year when they played a little bit more spread out after Oscar Tshiebwe transferred and everything. I mean, he averaged like 16 and 6 assists a game and like was throwing some very real high level looks based off of what the defense was like giving him. So I was not anticipating seeing him as like a top 25 guy, but that's kind of where I'm at with him now. I mean, where are you at? Like, is there someone like that for you now where like you feel like, oh wow, they're like way people may not be thinking about them enough?
You know what, to be honest with you, my wheelhouse is in that like 30 to 100 range, and with my new job and you know, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh shoot, sorry about that, it went completely black. I'm sorry about that, man.
You're good.
Okay. Gosh, what was I saying?
Yeah, just restart. I'll be able to edit this. This is easy.
Okay, cool. Sorry about that. Yeah, typically my wheelhouse is kind of in that 30 to 100 range, like where I'm coming from as far as like G League, you know, executive. And I love that area because like the two ways, the Exhibit 10 guys, those are like my favorite, players to find. But to be honest with you, just with work and, I haven't had the time to really dig into like that back half, but off the top of my head, like, I'm a big Derek Alston fan. I have been for the last years. As you know, Sam, I'm a sucker for 6'9 guys that show any type of ball skills and versatility, the Jaden McDaniels of the world. But, I don't have an answer for you yet, but I will. Let's have another conversation here in the next couple of weeks, and I promise you I will have the answer for you. But guys that, like, kind of – like, Austin Reeves is kind of interesting to me. I don't know. I'm kind of curious about this, like – and again, I haven't done the intel or as much research on some of these guys as I need to before the draft. But that, like you talked about, 6 to 20 range or even 6 to 30, like some of these guys that, you know, the Brandon Bostons, the Josh Christophers, the Zaire Williams, like some of those guys that were initially supposed to be lottery guys. I wonder if that's where the value is in this draft. If you think that, if you're a believer that like lack of success in their freshman year was temporary, and you would bet on it long term, or like the development that eventually happening. I don't know. Maybe that is the sweet spot of this year's draft, but that's just some of the things I'm trying to think of. No,
well,
I didn't answer your question, but and I apologize. But.
Well, like with Zaire, was it you I was talking to? I can't remember. Yeah, you
I think so.
Where it was like you just kind of brought up like he's never been good.
Oh no, that wasn't me. But
okay,
I was talked about Zaire a little bit.
Yeah, I was talking to someone and they brought up the fact like Zaire has just never been like great. You know, like he's never statistically in terms of production been as good as what you would think based off of his reputation, right? But when I go back and watch his tape, I kind of love the way that even though it was not great this year and he was very inefficient and he struggled at times, like I kind of thought this is like NBA level tape just in terms of the way he gets to step back, the way that you can see like the contact balance is just off right now because he's not strong enough. Like as he gets stronger, you can see how he's going to like really improve. I think I would take Zaire. Like Zaire's like pretty close to the lottery for me. Like I get it that it's that's probably like a hot take given how like poor his season went, but I think I would still take him pretty close to the lottery at this point.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, again, it's hard to find 6'8". I mean, to me, positional size is like one of the immediate things that translates. You have to have, as I'm personally, as I evaluate these guys, like he has the frame. Yeah, but as you said, if he gets a little stronger, you know, shot cleans up a little bit and becomes a little more efficient as a shooter, I feel like you can't teach some of these qualities that he has.
Yeah.
We see guys like him playing roles on several rosters, and so yeah, I'm kind of with you. I think he's a little lower.
I can't tell if like this year we're just getting smarter at evaluating, but like I feel like positional size is not a problem this year for guys. Like there aren't many undersized guys that like people are really excited about. Like Davion Mitchell is maybe a little bit undersized, but he's like 6'2 with like a 6'7 wingspan or something like that, and like right, that's not right. A disaster for the point guard position. Like James Bouknight is like 6'5 with like a 6'10 wingspan. It's not a disaster. Garuba is undersized for sure. Beyond that though, like, you know, Jaden Springer is maybe a bit undersized for the wing position that he's gonna have to play. But like Trey Murphy is 6'9". Sharif is very small too. But Trey Murphy is 6'9". Kessler Edwards is 6'8". Like Jalen Johnson is 6'9". And Zaire 6'8". And Corey Kispert 6'7" and strong. And
yep.
Franz Wagner 6'9". And yeah, Giddey 6'8". Chris Duarte is 6'6". Like these dudes just like have and Scotty Barnes is enormous. Like these dudes have real size for the position they're supposed to play. Is that like confirmation bias where we're getting smarter so we're moving those guys up a little bit or what? But it feels like teams have gotten smarter with like positional size being important for the next level than what it has been in the past.
Yeah, totally. I mean, to me it's like positional size, feel for the game, having some type of skill that translates, preferably shooting or playmaking, obviously, in today's game. But yeah, those are kind of the, and then you have to have a baseline of athleticism, I think, is the final one of the final pieces. But all those things, I feel like you're right, as we get, And that's kind of like the beauty, as we talk about, like we go back and do our own redrafts. Is we've had conversations in the past couple of years of like, yeah, where did you hit? Where did you miss? Those are kind of always the fun conversations and what eventually help like perfect our eye, I guess. So,
yeah. No, totally. Like, I enjoy talking about my misses because, like, A, it's fun to, like, make yourself look like a dumbass, and then B, like, you don't learn otherwise. Like, if you don't figure out, hey, how the hell did I have Rudy Gobert as, like, a second-round pick? Like, how did I fuck that up? You know, you're not going to learn. You're not going to figure it out, right?
No, 100%. I feel like that's you have to have some accountability and be able to like live with that. I mean, we drafted Marvin Bagley. I mean, and I at the end of the day, like hindsight is 20/20. But at the time, like day of the draft, I felt really good about Marvin as a prospect. And I guess the biggest takeaway from that draft for me was don't draft for position, draft by the best player available. And listen, like I still think Marvin's gonna be a good player. I could probably use a change of scenery, but you know, these are all things that you have to be willing to, you know, go back and evaluate. And I've had a lot of successful hits on the same. I mean, it's all just a process, and like you know, really, this is the fun part of scouting to me is like, hey, I was right about this kid. This is why this kid didn't work out. And drafts are so much of drafts are situational, as we've also talked about. And so it's an art, though. It's a beauty. It's what keeps us going every single year, right?
Yeah, like it's like everyone tries to make it a bit of a science, and it's just not. Like every kid is so drastically different from the other, like the rest of them. Like trying to figure out, like it really is like every prospect is like an individual snowflake, because like, you know, even if you just like think of it from the perspective of like, do you know like what a radar chart looks like? Like those charts where like the spark charts, like with athletes in the NFL draft is like what I'm thinking of. Like, you know, they have like 95th percentile passing and then like 94th percentile vision and then 20th percentile shooting and 99th percentile ball handling and 0 percentile defense. And I just like described like Sharif Cooper, right? But like then you've got like another player who has, you know, X number of skills that plays the same role, plays a different position. And like, you know, you can kind of think of it that way. Like it's really, really challenging. Like I love the draft. Like I was talking to, I won't say the coach's name. It's a conversation. Well, no, I will. Cause it's actually not that bad. Like, you know, Mark Few, I was having a conversation with Mark Few one time, and Mark Few asked me like, why do you do what you do? Like what, you know, not many people in the media like do like draft evaluation. Like there are like five of us, right? That are like any good at it. And Mark was just like, why do you do this? Like, why do you like play like the stock market game of evaluating prospects? And I was just like, you know, like it's not a game to me. Like I really do enjoy trying to navigate and evaluate each player and trying to figure out like what their career is going to look like. I understand that it's not an exact science. I understand that like, you know, it's not traditional reporting or whatever. Right. But it is fun to me. I really enjoy the process of trying to get better at this. Like, I feel like at a certain point, like you can get better at writing. Like you can perfect the craft. Like you're never going to perfect the craft at writing. But to me, like this is much more fun and complicated. And like, you know, I'm sure that there are journalists out there that are like, you know, fuck you, you don't get it. But like I feel like this doing this is more interesting to me and more fun, and there are more pieces to it than just like writing stories. You know what I mean? And reporting.
Totally. Yeah, it's like, yeah, and it's all opinion based, and so no one's right, no one's wrong. Some players end up being better than others, obviously, but yeah, I completely agree with you. I feel like, and ultimately, I think we're both just basketball junkies, and so like, having the ability to have these conversations, break players down, try and project them at the next level, try and project them relative to like a team's needs. is like super fun to me. That was like the, again, like I never felt like I was working a day in my life working for the Kings, because like you're doing what you love. And yep. I mean, I'm still, I have a medical device sales job in the morning that I have in the OR at 7 o'clock in the morning. And like I'll sometimes have these like 13 hour days where it's like a complex spine surgery, and like the first thing I want to do is come home and like, oh, what did I gotta go watch this Evan Mobley game, or like, oh shoot, I gotta catch the Kings are playing at 7. It's like, right, my mind just, this is like a, it's therapeutic for me, and it's just a way that like, it's just where my heart and my passion is, as it is with you, and you do a great job of this obviously, and so it's cool talking to another junkie himself and being able to break these guys down.
Yeah, it's great. It's super fun. We'll do this again. Drake, tell the people where they can follow you on your variety of social media platforms.
Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Drizzy_UU22. I also am on Instagram at DrizzyDrake22. And I feel like I'm also expecting a baby. I know I think I mentioned this to you before, in September. So I'm now going to be the I don't know if I'll be a super interesting Instagram follow, but I'll be on there probably I'll be that dad posting, you know, random pics of his son, you know, new shoes for the boy. But yeah, those are the two places that you can find me. I'll occasionally throw some random draft related tweets or stuff I'm doing with Pro Insight on the side. I'll kind of retweet and do stuff like that. So it's a fun way for me to kind of stay involved and up to date in the hoops world.
What are the first basketball shoes that you're going to get your child?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. My goodness, I feel like it's got to be a pair of Kobe's. I feel like, I mean,
pair of Kobe's. Okay,
a pair of Kobe's, I think, is what one of my buddies blessed me with, like some some J's. I'm not like a huge shoe head, but I think they're the Jordan ones. Seeing these things, they're like 4 inches long. It's so funny to me. I'm like, I didn't even know that Nike or Jordan made shoes for toddlers like this, but I'm getting a kick out of that. But yeah, I think that as far as the basketball shoe, he's going to come out, he's going to have a basketball in his hand, and we'll get straight to the gym as soon as Caitlin pops him out in September. So
as soon as, well, let's say, I don't know, 6 months, you know, maybe a year old, he can dribble a basketball at a year, right?
Yep. Oh yeah.
You can tell that I definitely have kids, let me tell you. There's no circumstance where I have kids. Like a year
sounds like the time that they can start shooting and doing left-handed layups.
Yeah, you know, like a year, like that, get them one of them small baskets, right? Like it'll be
exactly.
Fine.
Yep, exactly.
All right, this has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do anything you can to support the show. We'll be back later this week. NBA Combine invites are going out, and literally as we speak. I know that some have gone out over the weekend for sure, and I think that they're, I mean, you know this as well as I do, there's a second batch that typically goes out, right, Drake?
Yep.
Yeah, so I think that they're probably doing first batch now, and the second batch will go out later this week, and we'll you know, be able to talk about all that stuff in the NBA draft with Matt Penny later on, and I'm sure I'll do more playoff stuff. But until next time, we will talk soon. Bye.